is the Victorian Country Hour with Jane McNaughton on ABC Victoria.
Fears are growing. A deadly bird flu strain discovered in Australia's largest state is spreading after the H5N1 variant of the virus was confirmed in a bird found on a remote beach near Esperance in Western Australia, about 700 kilometres southeast of Perth. So today we'll look into what this means, not only for our environment, but for agriculture. And how well are Victorian poultry producers prepared if the virus spreads to our state? You'll hear the latest from government, farmers and avian influenza experts today on the program. But I'd also love to hear from you. Are you concerned about this virus spreading for our wildlife and for our agriculture? 0467 842 722 is the text line, or call in on 1300 977 222. And Kevin has already texted in saying good afternoon, Woz, but you can hear that it is Jane here today. Warwick's off a little bit crook, so I'm just filling in the chair for hopefully just today. But lovely to be with you. Kevin has texted in saying that in Myrtleford there's been 6 millimetres of rain over the weekend. That text line again is 0467 842 722. Officials say so far that there's no evidence a deadly strain of bird flu detected in Western Australia has been spreading in poultry or wild bird populations in the country. The H5 strain of avian influenza has been confirmed after tests done in Geelong found the presence of the strain in a migratory bird found sick on a beach in WA South, while the second bird in that area, a giant pegrel, has also been detected to have the H5 variant of influenza. The highly contagious disease has devastated wildlife populations overseas. Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer Beth Cookson has urged members of the public to be on the lookout for any further signs of the disease in bird life across the country.
At this early stage, it is difficult to make a conclusion about whether the infection has established in wildlife populations. It is not present in our poultry or agriculture production systems. The Western Australia Department is undertaking surveillance to better understand the situation on the ground. I understand this will be concerning news for many Australians who, like me, have a strong connection to our wildlife. We have been carefully preparing for this event for a long time. We have had the benefit of learning from the international experience, and this means that the investment that government and along with state and territory jurisdictions and industry have made have left us as best prepared as possible to respond to this situation. We continue to be on alert looking for signs of disease, and the most important message for the public is to assist this through our strong biosecurity system. If you encounter sick or dead birds, we are asking that you avoid contact with them, that you record information about the location of the dead bird, as well as take any information that might be helpful to us, like videos or photographs, and report that to our emergency animal disease hotline. There is a lot of information available on our birdflu.gov.au website, and I encourage people who are interested or concerned to make use of those resources.
Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins says the next week is vital in finding out more about the first ever detection of the dangerous strain of bird flu.
We will know within a few days about whether or not this has established itself in any populations in Australia, or whether it's migratory birds that have come up from the subantarctic, for instance. So we'll know a bit more detail within a few days of this investigation on how bird flu got into Australia. This is our first detection, and I want to reiterate that it's not widespread. There's no evidence of any mass mortalities, and there's no evidence that it's in our poultry or our agricultural system at this stage.
Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer Beth Cookson was asked a question about the danger of the bird flu for humans.
The circumstances where humans mostly become infected are those where they are in very close contact with sick or dying animals or the environment. And where we see more serious implications of exposure is usually where there's an underlying health concern as well. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't be taking precautions. And as I've mentioned, the best way of doing that is to avoid contact in the first place.
Are there risks of human to human transferability, or is it mostly from birds to humans in isolation?
What I can say is that the Australian Centre for Disease Control is very actively monitoring and has public information available. The global assessment of the human-to-human transmission risk is rated as low.
That's Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer, Dr. Beth Cookson, ending that report from Tony Briscoe. The Federal Environment Minister, Murray Watt, will hold an emergency meeting with his state counterparts today to discuss the bird flu outbreak. Senator Watt says that they are taking a national approach to the issue.
We've been working very hard with states, industry, environment groups, scientists over the last couple of years to make sure that we are as well prepared as we possibly could be. As a government, we've invested $113 million, including $11 million in the most recent budget in those preparedness efforts. So I feel confident that we've got the systems in place and that we're working cooperatively with states, territories and others to make sure that we can manage this outbreak if it does get more serious. But bringing those ministers together today will again ensure that we are on the same page. That follows a number of phone calls that I've had with state and territory ministers over the weekend. And we've had a number of other official committees meeting across the weekend, including with stakeholders, about this as well. We'll continue to work with all of those parties to make sure that we are managing this incident as quickly as we can. Of course, we don't want to see the outbreak get any wider, but if it does occur, we do have those systems and preparedness plans in place to manage this.
That was Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt there. And, of course, you can keep reading about this developing situation on the ABC Rural website as well, if you'd like a little bit more detail there. So we've heard from the federal government. Let's see what this now means for us here in Victoria. Dr. Graham Cook is Victoria's Chief Veterinary Officer. He joins us now. Good afternoon, Graham.
Good afternoon, Jen, and thank you for asking me on at this time.
I appreciate you making yourself available, Graham. So we just heard there from the Federal Environment Minister, Murray Watt, about there being some meetings on today. Have you been in attendance to any meetings as yet?
Yes, there has been much preparedness for this event. And, of course, there's a plan for day one, two and three. And that is rolling out. But I would just repeat some of the key messages. This is the first time that H5 of this high pathogenicity strain has been detected in Australia. Identified in a long-range migratory seabird on the southern coast of Australia, a very remote area. There are no detections in Victoria at present, but I would really like to thank those members of the public who very proactively have reported dead birds at the weekend, which will undergo testing. And there's no evidence of any impacts in Victoria at this present time. But I would ask listeners to follow the advice which all jurisdictions are given, as well as the federal government, which is to report groups of birds which are dead, more than five in number, or single penguins, pelicans, birds of prey, marine mammals. This is a type of avian influenza that affects seals and other dolphins and so on, and also of particular interest in Victoria, black swans. And the reporting number is 0800 675 888, or you can find further details on the Agriculture Victoria website.
We've spent a number of years talking, Graham, you and I, about bird flu, but the H7 variant that wiped out more than 2 million laying hens over the past few years. This is a much more deadly strain. So how concerned are you about this incursion?
This is a very much more deadly type of avian influenza. Avian influenza does, as we all know, change and alter. And this particular strain has moved across the Northern Hemisphere down into Southern Asia, but it moved very quickly through North America into South America and is now in the subantarctic region, where we now know it has caused very, very high levels of mortality in seal pups, for example. 75% of seal pups on Heard Island are now known to have perished from it. It's also unusual in that it's not just highly pathogenic to commercial poultry, should it ever get into those systems, but it also affects a wide range of other mammals. And as you heard, fortunately, humans are very, 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 very low risk of infection. It needs a high level of contact, and there's no evidence of human-to-human transmission. But the advice would be to avoid contact with dead birds, but do record the location, provide as much information as members of the public can, and of course use that to report.
So having dealt with the H5 variant and successfully eradicating that from Victoria over a number of years, how well prepared has that experience made our biosecurity? Like, have you been doing war game situations as part of that?
Yes, we have, if that's the name you'd like to use. We've been exercising and we have been doing scenario planning. We have watched this particular type of avian influenza and the effects it's had for over 200 million birds in North America alone have been destroyed by it in the poultry industry. Many iconic species in different parts of the world, in South America, for example, have been badly affected by it. And we have been working, therefore, with wildlife colleagues within the Victorian government, where we share the same department. We're all both in the Department of Energy, Environment and Climate Action. And we have been exercising together within the state, but also multi-jurisdictional exercises. And across using the federal National Emergency and Task Force for H5N1. I would say, though, that Victoria has learnt a lot, unfortunately, having to learn a lot from past outbreaks of H7 that you've referred to, and that has really accelerated our increases in capability. And there is an increasing global threat from foreign or emergency animal diseases in general. And we have spent within the Victorian government, we've applied over $90 million to general preparedness capability. That is not just hardware, not just planning, not just systems improvement. It is also training. And one of the best ways of training is through exercises.
And unfortunately, as you said, having to deal with the H7 variant in real life a few years ago as well. You are listening to the Victorian Country Hour. Jane McNaughton here with you today. It is 17 minutes past 12. I'm joined by Agriculture Victoria's Chief Veterinary Health Officer, Dr. Graham Cook, and we are speaking about the H5 incursion of bird flu that was found in a bird in Western Australia over the weekend. So the federal government committed more than $95 million in biosecurity to amp up our preparedness for H5 bird flu, with environmental and public health funding in last October of a further $11.2 million just before this announcement. So what sort of cash is the Victorian government contributing to this?
So as I referred to earlier on, we have applied over $90 million to the preparedness effort for emergency animal diseases in general. There are several diseases which are getting closer and closer to Australia. This is a type of disease which is carried by wild birds, long-distance migratory birds in the first instance, and then it can get into local native populations, and we call that establishment. The effort at the moment is for Western Australia to understand if there have been other long-range migratory birds or local native birds which are infected with this disease, and that will play a very large decision in further actions, whether it's been established. But it is, as I said, it's a very, very timely reminder that this disease can cover extremely large distances by means of migratory birds.
And Dr. Graham Cook, what was that emergency disease hotline again?
1-800-675-888. This is a time of great uncertainty to try and understand the extent of this detection and the implications for Australia. So we really would like all Victorians to be actively vigilant and use that reporting line. You look at the Agriculture Victoria website, should they have concerns about the types of dead birds that we referred to. You did ask about our general preparedness effort. We've had nearly 2 years of looking towards this possibility, knowing that this virus has been very difficult to stop across the world.
Well, Dr. Graham Cook, really appreciate your time today on the Country Hour, and fingers crossed we're not talking about this again in a few weeks' time.
Yes, we all hope so, but we must maintain vigilance because this virus has shown an ability that where it is, it tends to stay for a long time. So we would expect it to be to our north in Asia and to our south in the Antarctic region for some time to come. So this surveillance effort, this vigilance effort has to be constant.
Thank you for your time, Dr. Graham Cook there, Victoria's Chief Veterinary Officer. Victorian Farmers Federation Group President Brian Ahmed says the discovery is not a surprise to the industry.
I guess it's a concern, but it's not a surprise for egg farmers or poultry farmers. We've been aware of the HI avian influenza virus for some time, and we've been watching it closely worldwide. We have been taking precautions. I mean, a lot of farmers have upped biosecurity in their they're preparing themselves for what may eventually. But at the moment, with a remote place in WA, we're not overly concerned, but we are very vigilant and upping up our biosecurities and preparing for the worst.
Do you think it's inevitable that it will come to Victoria?
As farmers, we've always said it's only a matter of when. We've never thought that it would never get here to Australia. We were just preparing for the day it does come. This highlights the importance of all our farming systems, you know. I mean, we as farmers do our best as free-range caged and farmers, but there's one thing a free-range farmer can't do, and that's control wild birds coming onto farms. And it's very clear that the wild birds are the carriers of this virus.
Hundreds of thousands of birds died last year due to a different strain of the virus. If this comes, if you say it's a matter of when, you know, what kind of effect do you think it will have, the same again?
Well, I'm only going by what the experts say. I'm a farmer, and I said, well, we've already had AI here, so why are we over-concerned? But apparently this HVIVE virus is far more virulent and spreads far more quickly and would have more impact than the H7 virus. And so that really concerns us because we lost over 2 million birds a few years ago. If this spreads a lot quicker, we'll be culling a lot more birds than we did.
And what is the industry doing to prepare? I know it's quite tricky for free-range farmers, but is there anything that they're doing to protect themselves?
Well, the only thing farmers can do is control biosecurity on their farms. And, of course, you know, indoor environment's far more controllable, so you can control biosecurity a lot more. But on a free-range farm, you know, you can do everything humanly possible, but we can't control wild birds, and that's the risk. So we here in Australia, we want to make sure Australians got food security. So that's how we control our food supply chain, is by having a combination of all our farming systems. Farmers are doing the best they can, but there is some areas that are uncontrollable. And wild birds is the one.
That's Victorian Farmers Federation Egg Group President and Caged Egg Producer in Werribee, Brian Ahmed, speaking with Eden Henninen. Well, to get that perspective on open or free-range farming, Boyd Carmody joins us now. You run an egg-laying flock near Creswick, north of Ballarat. What are you doing to prepare, considering that your birds are outdoors?
Well, we've been busy preparing since the last outbreak. We've spent several hundred thousand dollars upgrading our houses so that if the call does come from Agriculture Victoria, we can actually lock our birds up off the grounds now. Our new houses have conventional onboard chain-style feeders that you find in your big barns, onboard water and rollaway nest boxes and the works.
Do you think that your system in particular is under more threat if you were going to get a H5 incursion compared to a caged egg facility?
Oh, obviously, with us being outside in the great outdoors, there's that risk of migratory ducks and that sort of thing passing. But we're a long way off the local migratory bird corridor here, which essentially comes up through Geelong, Lethbridge, Bannockburn sort of corridor, and that's over 100 kilometres away from where we're situated.
And that's obviously where a lot of this H7 variant and the culling happened a couple of years ago. How concerned are you about this discovery in Western Australia at this stage?
At this stage, not too bad. It's only in a couple of migratory birds so far that wouldn't normally come this way, this far north, except for the fact that they've been sick and they've had to head for land. I'm sure the good scientists will be doing plenty of homework over there and tracking what's going on. I know they've got a tracking station down at Werribee Sewage Farm, where they actively track and test the migratory birds down there for all sorts of nasty things.
And we just heard from Dr. Graham Cook, Victoria's Chief Veterinary Officer with Agriculture Victoria there. He said there's been meetings this morning. As a producer, have you heard anything from Agriculture Victoria yet?
No, nothing yet. The only posts that I've seen so far have been Agriculture New South Wales. Victoria's a bit behind the eight ball. They're a bit slow down here sometimes.
Do you think that the Victorian government has invested enough time and resources and money into preparing for a H5 outbreak of avian influenza?
Oh, definitely not. The Victorian government seems to be more interested in tunnels to nowhere than what goes out on the farmlands here.
What more do you think they should be doing?
There should be a lot more active testing going on and maybe some farm visits from Agriculture Victoria, particularly given the smaller and newer producers, a few tips and ideas on what they can do to protect themselves a lot better than what they do.
And have you got any further plans to upgrade your facilities to protect your chooks?
Well, we're already most of the way. We're probably three quarters of the way through our upgrade, like I said, so we can lock our birds up off the ground. If need be, if there are wild bird problems in the area. But luckily for us, we're looking like a fairly mild, dry winter with any luck, and that's probably going to be Victoria's only saving grace.
And, Boyd, just before I let you go, how do you feel about the fact that this could threaten native wildlife as well, in addition to your business being a poultry producer?
The hit on wildlife, as what we've seen in Antarctica, has been pretty harsh. Hopefully it doesn't get that far. The area that the first birds are located is fairly isolated down there south of Esperance, and there's probably a fair separation before you get into any sort of intensive poultry operations.
Boyd Carmody, thank you very much for your time today on the Country Hour.
All right, thank you, Jane.
That's Boyd Carmody, their open range egg producer at Creswick Open Range Eggs, just north of Ballarat. Well, Professor Kirsty Short is with the University of Queensland. She's a virologist that specialises in avian influenza and how it interacts with poultry and with other wildlife. She also studied at the University of Melbourne and joins us on the program now. Kirsty Short, good morning. Good afternoon,
good
I should say.
Good, yeah, you got me there too. Good afternoon.
So what's your take on the situation so far?
Yeah, I think it's very early to sort of know what's happening. I think the key thing we need to know is, has this virus gone beyond the two birds? Were they just two migratory birds that, because they were sick, fell off their migration route and happened to land there and there was no onward spread? Or is this indicative of a wider problem where this has spread either locally or potentially through the country? So we're really just going to have to be waiting on the results of extensive surveillance that's now happening to try and better assess what position we're in.
We've got a few texts coming in just asking about what the progress towards a vaccine for this H5 variant would be. That's in from Arthur. And Rusty's text in saying, Jane, they developed a COVID vaccine. Are the gurus working on a vaccine for chooks? Is that a viable solution to just vaccinate our population?
Yeah, it's absolutely a consideration, and this has been part of the preparedness plans for avian influenza in Australia. There is an H5N1 vaccine available for chickens as well as for people. The thing to remember about this vaccine, though, is that as soon as you vaccinate your poultry, some countries will not let you export poultry to them. So it has significant economic impacts, and so it's not a really clear-cut case of a vaccine will solve it all. Similarly, the human vaccine, where it's been available, for example, in Finland to people at high risk because of their occupation, the uptake hasn't been very high, probably reflecting the fact that the risk of human spread is low. So there are vaccines available. Whether or not they're going to be the most appropriate solution here is a bit different to what we had in COVID.
So you mentioned the best case scenario earlier, that these two birds are isolated and it hasn't actually spread into the wild bird population in Australia yet. What's the worst case situation?
The worst case is that it has spread and that it's spread undetected, which I doubt because we do have really good surveillance, but that it's spread beyond those two birds, I think. And then as soon as we've got it in our wild bird population, and then that that's going to be a cause of concern.
And what native animals in particular are you concerned about?
I'm concerned about a lot of our native animals. We've done a study showing that black swans are uniquely susceptible to avian influenza. So, of course, I'm concerned about them. I'm concerned about our sea mammals because we've already seen what's happened in Antarctica as well as in South America. But I'm also concerned about our scavenger species, in particular species like the Tasmanian devil. These can become infected by feeding on dead or dying birds. And we already know the problems the devil has had in terms of the tumour facial disease, and we already know that their immune system is a little bit impaired. So it's really across the board, as well as being concerned about animals that are already endangered, and this would just be another blow to them.
You are listening to the Victorian Country Hour. It has just ticked over to 12:30. I'm speaking with Professor Kirsty Short, a virologist with the University of Queensland, who specialises in the way that avian influenza can affect wildlife and also agriculture. Speaking of that, Chris has texted in on the text line, which is 0467 842 722, saying, Jane, Anthony Albanese will need to rethink his ban on caged poultry when the H5 bird flu gets here, and it will. All caged poultry will be decimated. The only safe chickens will be caged birds. Would you agree with that?
Look, certainly we know that without the appropriate biosecurity measures, birds that are outside and in contact with wild birds are at higher risk of infection. But this all depends on a lot of things. It depends on what biosecurity measures you already have in place. It also depends on what wild species, if avian influenza does indeed get into our wild bird populations, what wild bird populations. So it's not a clear cut thing. I know this sounds very wishy-washy to say, but this is just, we're very early in this situation, so I think we can't go jumping to conclusions.
Before I let you go, is there anything else that you think that our audience needs to know at this stage?
No, I think just know that we have been preparing for this. This was an inevitability. We knew it was. So it's upsetting, but it's not shocking that this has happened. And we've just got to be ready to respond accordingly.
Professor Kirsty Short, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Professor Kirsty Short, the University of Queensland virologist. And if you do notice anything out in the wild, that emergency disease hotline again is 1800 675 888. It is 28 minutes to the news at 1 o'clock, so I better get a rush on and deliver you some rural news. Emma Field has that for us today. Good afternoon.
G'day, Jane. Now, you've been talking about the bird flu case that's been found on a remote beach near Esperance, WA. Now, let's hear from a senior Esperance-based vet who says he's proud of his two colleagues who called authorities about the sick birds. Dr. Enoch Bergman says the work regional veterinarians do in surveillance means these types of exotic diseases can be detected early. He says pro bono wildlife work is an important part of their veterinary practice, as well as working with authorities on these types of biosecurity outbreaks.
Two young veterinarians in our practice, Tony and Alex, both of them independently of one another, essentially led to the diagnosis of this index case of avian influenza, which is just phenomenal. I'm still proud of them. And it has to do with the whole community. It was a team effort. You know, our local wildlife care LA working with Tony, and then Alex taking that step with that second case, both independent of each other. Bang, we now know we have an issue, and we can train the local community to keep their eye out, to reach out to that emergency disease hotline. The department will then communicate with us as to whether or not they want us to render assistance. It's obviously a concern. I reckon the recent weather, which was quite severe, potentially, you know, we know there's an outbreak on Heard Island, and it's affected a lot of seal pups. It's been in the media. And potentially this last mega storm, or quite significant storm we had here in Esperance, potentially push these index cases into Esperance. The good news is now that we're aware that it is possible, we knew it was there, we've been talking about it for a couple of years, but now that we know that it is, could be and is a reality, now it's going to elevate our surveillance. The department generally on these sorts of things, but now because we've had a couple index cases, that's going to elevate the criteria for active intervention and investigation. And so whenever they need us, we're going to be there to help them. Thank God they're there to help us.
Australia exported more than $3.8 billion worth of horticultural produce last year, but delays in getting it from farm to shelf can be costly and affect quality. But a new government horticulture exporter trial to improve the flexibility and speed of getting quicker certification is underway. Department of Agriculture Assistant Secretary in the Plant Export Office, Gemma Martin, explains what the trial is hoping to achieve.
To export most agricultural products, including horticulture, you need a government-issued export certificate. And this tells the importing country that the produce meets their requirements, it's free from pests and diseases, and it's safe to enter their country. And the horticulture fast-track trial came about from industry telling us that sometimes they need greater flexibility when applying for export certificates and faster turnaround times. Because as a premium but perishable product, it's really important that it gets from harvest to the final point of sale really quickly to maintain quality and to get the best price. Our standard service for providing export certification is 1 day for air freight and 3 days for sea freight. So with the trial, we're looking at where there is genuine need for a faster service, and so that in a fair and equitable way, we can prioritise those requests.
Now, Jane, career changing into being a sheep farmer in your 40s is not the usual way people get into the industry. But Bronwyn Douglas, who farms at Wynyard in Tassie's northwest, went from corporate life in America and is now about to embark on her first spring lambing season. She says it's taken 5 years, lots of help and study to get to this point.
Where I thought in my 40s it would be a good idea to start a farm. I came from a corporate background and was just, quite frankly, burnt out. But I love learning, and there's been so much opportunity to go into farming and learn. And I found, particularly in Tasmania, that everyone has been so friendly and welcoming.
What was the property like when you first bought it?
It hadn't really been touched for quite some time. It was covered with thistles. I think I moved out over a period of time, 42 truckloads of debris and rubbish, and did lots of burn-offs. I spent about 3 years just cleaning up the property, balancing the soil and learning. I went and studied ag at TAFE and also went and spent some time on some farms. I went to a biodynamic farm on the mainland and went over for their lambing season, and they invited me back for shearing. And it was just a great experience to get that really hands-on practical experience. And then next month, before I lamb in September, I'll be going down to a farm in Evandale and just getting a bit more experience there as well.
And that wraps up Rural News.
Thank you very much, Emma Field, there today with us for Rural News. And now I can bring you Ursula Connor, Senior Forecaster with the Bureau of Meteorology, to check in on the weather. It's lovely and sunny here in Sale. How's it looking around the rest of the state?
Hi, Jane. Yes, you are there in one of the pockets of sunshine around the state at the moment. There's also a bit of sun sort of through the southwest and the northern country as well, but quite cloudy through most of the rest of the state. We've still got a fair bit of fog hanging on too through the Mallee. They started the day really foggy up there, just starting to sort of clear and lift in the last hour or so. So we'll see that continue over the next hour. But yeah, otherwise, a bit of cloud around. Could catch a very light shower out of some of that cloud, mainly through those western districts, but really not expecting much in the way of rainfall for the day today, Jane.
And what about over the weekend? There was a bit of rain around. We've got a text in from Leo at Rose River saying, "G'day, Jane, 45.5 mils with this last rain event in that area." So was there much rain across the weekend?
Yeah, look, as we over the last sort of 2 days over the weekend, it was mainly through those eastern districts and the high country there as well. So the most that we've got is sort of Mount Buffalo Chalet in that northeast district picked up 52 millimetres. So, yeah, largely speaking through that part of the world, we saw sort of between 20 and 30 millimetres with a few isolated higher totals, most of Gippsland picking up around sort of 15 to 25 millimetres as well.
And so run us through the rest of the week. What can we expect across the state?
Look, a largely settled week for most of the state. There will be a weak cold front that will move through Bass Strait tomorrow. So that'll see the winds through the southern parts of the state tend a little bit more southerly. So we start to see a bit of cloud pushing onshore and just some isolated showers with that. So it'll mainly be about the coastal fringes tomorrow, possibly pushing in as far as sort of the divide on Wednesday, but really not expecting much more than a millimetre or so that far inland. It'll be mainly confined to the coast, so the southwest coast and the Bass coast there especially could just pick up a couple millimetres over the next few days, but elsewhere across the state we've got that ridge maintaining over the northern parts, so again seeing those sort of cold mornings, potentially a bit of frost through the north as well and maybe some fog each morning, but yeah, those cold starts and crisp days for the north, and that high will start to push south over the whole state sort of late Wednesday onwards. So relatively settled weather for the week ahead, Jane.
Wonderful. So, yeah, no warnings or sheep grazes for frost. It was very frosty here this morning in Gippsland.
Look, we just have currently the warning out for the Kiwa River, just the minor flood warning there, but that should be being finalised as we move into the next couple of days.
Wonderful. Ursula, thank you so much for all your wisdom today.
Thanks, Jane. See you.
That's Ursula Connor there, Senior Forecaster with the Bureau of Meteorology.
The Victorian Country Hour with Jane McNaughton on ABC Victoria.
And you are listening to the Victorian Country Hour. It is 20 minutes to the news at 1 o'clock. We were speaking earlier in the program about fears growing that a deadly bird flu strain discovered in Australia's largest state of WA could spread throughout Australia. We have so far until just before the weekend been free. We're the only continent that was free of this virus. So we've got some texts coming in on that, which is 0467 842 722. One from Arthur saying, who cares about export issues when we need local food and we need to care about the welfare of our wildlife? That one's from Arthur. And Lyndon just asking, saying, hi Jane, I'm assuming the basic measure to decrease wild bird contact with free range chickens is keeping watering and feeding points under cover. Lyndon, that's correct. Unless there is a housing order in place, basically a lot of producers that I've been speaking to over the last few years have been trying to minimise access to dams where wild birds are and the like, and the advice is to 100% separate any sort of food or feeding from anywhere where wild birds are frequent, and that emergency hotline if you do just suspect that you have seen a dead bird that may have avian influenza. That number is 1-800-675-888. Now, staying with the poultry industry, but shifting gears quite a lot now, an egg producer on the outskirts of Melbourne in the suburb of Doreen, called Doreen Egg Australia, has paid nearly $40,000 in penalties for allegedly making false or misleading claims that its eggs were free-range. Doreen Eggs has admitted it sold eggs labelled as free-range, despite the hens not having access to an outdoor range, as required under the free-range labelling information standard. They paid $39,600 in penalties after the ACCC issued two infringement notices. Joining us now to tell us all about this case is ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. So what has the ACCC alleged that this egg farm has done wrong?
Well, two things really. The first was to breach the free-range egg standard, which has a number of elements to it, but essentially requires that the birds have outdoor access normally up to 8 hours a day and a stocking density under 10,000 birds per hectare. When we investigated this particular producer, there was strong evidence that the birds didn't have access to a range on quite a few days and therefore were not eligible to be considered to be producing free-range eggs. So that was the first issue we identified. The second was that they were also using Australian Eggs, which is the industry representative organisation, branding on their packaging. And Australian Eggs doesn't endorse or and allow its label to be used as any sort of accreditation standard or evidence on packaging. So there were two breaches. One, the failure to actually comply with the free-range egg standard and therefore mislabeling eggs. And the second was to include the Australian Eggs Organisation label on its eggs, which was false and misleading as well.
So the company's paid about $40,000 for this infringement. Is that enough of a deterrent?
Well, we take a proportionate response to breaches. This is a small company. It runs about four sheds. It supplies a couple of wholesalers and largely locally within the region. So, you know, we've taken action previously that involved court, but that is a very expensive process and can be an extensive delay. This particular producer was prepared to admit to the breach, prepared to pay the fines and also to adopt a court-enforceable undertaking that includes independent audits and inspection over the next few years. So we thought that's a proportionate response for a business of this size, and that's why we took that approach rather than the more extended and much more expensive court-enforceable approach.
So more than 8,600 cartons of mislabeled eggs were sold in May and June of last year through two wholesalers, 30 small retailers and a direct farmgate sale. Do you think that this is going to damage the trust that consumers have in the free-range brand?
Well, I think that's the concern. You know, free-range eggs typically retail for $5 or more above the price of caged eggs. And consumers who are making that purchasing decision value the fact that the hens have been subject to or managed under free-range conditions and are prepared to pay for it. If we breach consumers' trust in that regard, then they will no longer be prepared to pay that, and the market as a whole will suffer. So it is important to maintain the standard we've taken. This is the fifth action we've taken over the last decade in relation to the free-range egg standard. We do hear occasional reports. We investigate in situations like this where our investigation provided evidence that a breach had occurred. We take action. In others, there may be extenuating circumstances that may result in, and your mention of the bird flu issue was one in particular where there is discretion under the code for birds to be retained indoors or at least in a protected range to avoid that situation in terms of exposure to wild birds and therefore the risk of spreading bird flu. So, and certainly Victoria's had those examples in the last few years of the other version of bird flu and the action that has been taken there. So we hope consumers do retain confidence in the free-range standard because it's very important in terms of what they're prepared to pay for eggs. And we hope actions like this will help to encourage that.
Do you think that most consumers actually have an understanding of those minimum systems and standards that are eligible to be labelled as free-range?
No, and look, we're all consumers one way or another, and I think, you know, most of us get that sort of glazed look about us in a supermarket and rely on labelling and tags to give us the shortcuts to make the choices we make. I'm sure a lot of consumers would not have gone into the details of free-range extended and understand precisely what it means, but I'm sure they take a view that they think that free-range egg production is better and more acceptable from their perspective in terms of the treatment of the chooks than the alternative. So therefore, they're prepared to pay money to support that and should have confidence that the decision is appropriate.
Mick Keogh, thank you very much for bringing us the latest today on the Country Hour.
Thank you.
That's ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh there. And if you actually do have some confusion about the labelling of eggs in supermarkets, feel free to, I wrote an article about that, I think, just before Christmas last year. So you can just Google ABC free range eggs or Jane McNaughton free range eggs into your favourite browser, and that should come up too.
On ABC Victoria, you're with Jane McNaughton for the Victorian Country Hour.
It's expected the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority release its decision on paraquat this week. The regulator has committed to delivering its final decision on the controversial herbicide by the end of the month. It comes after a 2024 draft decision by the APVMA, which proposed putting limits on allowable rates because of the adverse impact on the environment. Grain Producers Australia spokesperson Andrew Wiedemann explains what the decision could mean for agriculture.
I guess we're approaching this week with a bit of trepidation at the moment. We've obviously done a lot of work in the background after the original draft report around paraquat and obviously the rates that were proposed in that sort of sub-lethal doses to where farmers would be using the products today. So we're hopeful that the work we've put forward will be able to at least increase the grams per active that growers will be able to use in a season on their paddocks.
And, of course, we've got really no inkling what the decision will be. But if it's in line with the draft decision, and there's a lot of detail there, but in general there are significant limits on allowable rate use, what would the implication of those rate limitations be?
The two tools that we use for conservation tillage are critically these two products, paraquat and diquat, as well as glyphosate. So paraquat is, becoming, I think I said to somebody the other day, I think it's actually the number one knockdown product that we're now using here in Australian agriculture. Right, and this is right around Australia these products are being used too, Angus.
So if you were only allowed to use a rate that didn't really do the job, what would happen then?
Obviously, we have to be a lot more work done on how and what we can use as other products that are added with paraquat to try and pull down ryegrass in particular. That's the main reason it's being used. You know, like Teridor or Vraxor or all these newer additives that actually help pull down ryegrass plants at that knockdown stage. But, there's a few things in the pipeline, but these are all untested new products coming through the pipeline, Angus. So I think at the moment, we're very much reliant on paraquat and glyphosate to continue to farm the way we do. And I think we've said it before on this program, and other farmers, right around Australia have said the same thing. Like, it's basically going to turn us back to the 70s and 80s if we had to keep farming. And I think there'll be a lot of people that would, find that very difficult to do from a business sense.
And given there are already numerous examples of resistance, not just to glyphosate, but to paraquat, if you're using a low rate, does that mean that you will promote paraquat resistance in ryegrass particularly?
Well, look, if you're using a sublethal dose of anything, I think we definitely see that facilitate a quicker resistance framework.
Do you think farmers would ignore a limitation on allowable rates and just use whatever they felt they needed to do?
Oh, well, you could speculate that they might do that, Angus, but at the end of the day, they've still got to be able to purchase it. And one of the problems we've got here is that a lot of the companies that are obviously with the labels that are there at the moment would probably be reconsidering whether or not that an efficacious rate would be able to be used, and so whether they'd even market it and label it. And so that's our bigger problem. It's the regulatory system might foreshadow, like they did in that draft review, that there's lower rates, but then it comes down to, well, will the manufacturers actually continue to produce the product based on the fact that the usage and the rates that are being proposed would actually be sublethal doses to facilitate weed control in a timely fashion?
When it comes to the decision the APVMA is making, they're not really going to factor in the importance of paraquat for farming systems, are they? They're going to be looking at environmental impacts?
Yeah, so look, this is a really key area we are looking at from a Grain Producer Australia point of view in terms of how we need to just change the legislation that gives them a better way of assessing things into the future, regardless of whether it's paraquat or any of the other products. they do base it on environmental impacts, but what they're not taking into account is when you take a product away from the environment, what impacts that will have on the environment as well. And I think, you know, all the listeners that are listening from, you know, in farmland realise just how much we've improved our soils, we've improved our productivity over the journey of the last 30 to 40 years with no-till farming and the way that we go about it. And so that's not being taken into account here when you take these products out of the marketplace and they're not being replaced with anything else. We're really just leaving this the industry to bear the cost. This is not a situation that is palatable to growers. So, look, we'll be obviously, you know, working pretty hard to make sure that we can still continue to use the products until such time as there is something else that comes along. But when there is something else that comes along, Angus, you know, you see these activist groups out there attacking farming and attacking the way that we farm. They don't really understand agriculture or food production. And I really am seriously concerned about the fact that, you know, the politics of a full stomach type attitude of governments, and particularly we see this in Europe, where they're taking these things away from farmers and they're going back to tillage and actually degradation of the soil. So it's not a good situation. And the only way that we can fix this is through changing legislation that gives the regulator the ability to assess the overall impact to the environment.
That was Andrew Wiedemann, a Rapanyup farmer and research and development spokesperson for Grain Producers Australia, speaking with Angus Verley. Let's head off to the livestock markets, starting with Wagga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. Numbers dropped by 1,620 to a yarding of 4,520. Quality was fair to very good, with a few more trade types in the mix. Not all feedlot orders are in the market today, but despite these, prices are exceptionally strong. There was a lot more cattle under 330 kilos this week, with restockers competing strongly. Lightweight steers back to the paddock were firm, averaging $1,461, while the heifer portion averaged $1,390. Steers 280 to 330 kilo back to the paddock gained 10 cents to average $1,689. Feeder steers lightweight are firm, with the medium weights up 13 cents, 480 to 607. Trade steers are up 10 cents, 458 to 558. Feeder heifers lightweight lifted 34 cents, 490 to 566. Heavy feeder steers have surged ahead 50 cents, 510 to 610 cents a kilogram. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Thank you, Leanne. Let's head to Mortlake for a cattle update now with Chris Agnew. Good afternoon.
Mortlake agents yarded 2,397 head, a decrease of 315 compared to last week's sale. Quality was a little bit more mixed this week and tailed off quickly, back to crossbreds and dairy breeds, and mainly across the trade and bullock offering. The better cattle were supplementary fed, with over half the yarding being cows. Market generally remained firm for cattle in the trade section. However, in some places, cattle back to the paddock were a little bit softer due to their lack of breeding. However, the better bred cattle still remained firm. Bullocks sold to a top of 515, grown steers to 544, crossbred steers to 476, and the grown heifers 470 to 522. Dairy bred manufacturing steers to 428. The better quality trade cattle made from 480 to 534, with feeders paying up to 528. There's still 1,200 cows to be sold. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thank you, Chris. Let's check in on the lamb market now in Bendigo with Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Big drop in numbers, down to 7,400 lambs and just 1,530 sheep. The yarding nearly half that of a week ago. Not all orders operated fully, but the market was similar to Deera. The heavier processing lambs selling better today, provided they weren't super heavy. It meant the top prices in each agent's run weren't necessarily for the heaviest lambs, with the 30 to 33 kilo types often outselling the biggest export lambs. The lamb average today for everything sold was $298, to be up $15 on last week, but noting the makeup of the yarding can influence the figures. Export lambs, $340 to a top of $391, and the heavies, $296 to $356. Better trade lambs, $266 to $300 on limited numbers. Merino lambs are a bit hit and miss today. The heaviest are $344 and a lot of leaner trade types, $240 to $290. Sheep sold very well again, most averages dearer. Some big Dorset used to $382 and Merino used to $371. The sheep average today was $279 per head. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thank you, Jenny. And Caroline Ronald joins us from Corowa.
Good afternoon. Numbers were very limited, slipping back to just shy of 4,000 lambs and 1,220 sheep. Quality remains mixed with another good run of supplementary fed lambs with a lift in weight over the export lines. Not all buyers were present and operating in a dearer market. Overall trade lambs gained $10, heavy trade 23 to 26 kilos, $258 to $328 to average $1,262 per kilo carcass weight. Heavy lambs jumped $8, $335 to $370, and extra heavy export types were $15 dearer, $368 up to $420. Merino lamb numbers declined. Heavy lambs sold up to $320 and heavy trade gained $15, selling between $269 and $307. A lack of mutton resulted in dearer trends across all categories. Heavy and extra heavy mutton averaged $10 to $20 stronger, with extra heavy merino ewes making up to $300 and crossbreds up to $315. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Corowa.
Thank you, Caroline. That's about all we've got time for today on the Victorian Country Hour. Wishing Warwick well, Warwick Long, speedy recovery. Hopefully he'll be back in the chair with you tomorrow. And also wishing my old man McNaughton, a very happy birthday today as well. I'll catch you out at the farm later this afternoon. But that's all from me today on the Country Hour. News time now, 1 o'clock.